We've already covered this, right? The SLUD? That's what I thought. But just to get back into it, what exception of Mendelian genetics did this slide illustrate? What's going on here?
Incomplete dominance.
Exactly, incomplete dominance. And why is it incomplete? What makes this incomplete dominance versus complete dominance? Well, what is the definition of complete dominance? How do you know whether an allele completely dominates over another allele? If it's complete dominance, that means it takes only one allele of the dominant type to give that organism the full dominant phenotype, which is why in the pea flower color example, the heterozygotes, which are the F1s, they all only had one dominant purple allele, right? But they were just as purple flowered as the homozygous dominant purple flowered parent. So one or two alleles doesn't make any difference for dominant. As long as you have one, you are completely dominant in your phenotype. But that's not true for incomplete dominance. Other genes work differently. This is incomplete dominance, and therefore the heterozygous individuals, the ones with only one dominant allele, aren't fully red. They're partially red, which is what pink is. To become fully red, you have to have a double dose of the red allele. You have to be homozygous dominant. That's the difference. Okay, well anyway, that's a review. Let's go on to what we haven't covered yet. In slide 12, this actually is two examples in one. There's two different and independent reasons why this is an exception to Mendelian genetics. The example deals with human blood group. So let me first give you just a little bit of background on this in case you don't understand this already. Some of you might already know this. There are dozens of different human blood groups, most of which almost no one knows about because they're not really all that clinically important. There are two blood groups that are really clinically important because not paying attention to them can kill you if you get the wrong blood in a transfusion. And those are the ones that we actually kind of combine into one blood type, even though the two blood groups are totally unrelated to each other. One of those groups is the ABO group, which is the only one we're dealing with here. The other is the RH group. And so when you say, for instance, that your blood type is B negative, that really is two results in one. It means that you are B in the ABO group and you're negative in the RH group, but they have nothing to do with each other. And so the positive and negative isn't a part of this example at all. This is all about the ABO blood group. And this deals with this brings up the idea of antigens and antibodies. I guess I better get a pen. Antigens are particles of some sort. Sometimes they're proteins. They can be other things as well, though. But an antigen in general is some sort of particle that can be recognized by its shape by a special protein called an antibody. So antibodies are always proteins. Antigens can be just about anything. Antibodies work for immunity. Antibodies recognize things, antigens, that are not supposed to be there, basically, and therefore things that might hurt you. And when they recognize those antigens, antibodies start a chain of events that leads to destruction of the things that have the antigens. This is exactly how vaccines work, like a COVID vaccine. When you get the shot, you are spurring your body into producing specific antibodies that recognize that particular antigen, an antigen that's carried by the virus that causes COVID. So if you then are exposed to the real thing, you'll already have an army of antibodies of the correct type on hand that will overwhelm it before it can get a foothold and give you the disease. So antibodies are all about protecting you from foreign things that are called antigens. And antibodies themselves are proteins that are found in the plasma. Plasma is just part of whole blood. Whole blood is a tissue that contains two major parts. Cells of some sort, the blood cells in this case, and the plasma, which is the liquid component outside of the cells but still part of the blood. And that the plasma is where you find the antibodies. The blood cells themselves are six kinds, really. There's five major types of white blood cells, which are a tiny, tiny fraction of the overall blood cells. Almost all of your blood cells are red blood cells, which are the ones we're concerned with here. And red blood cells can have antigens on them, which are illustrated in this cartoon version as the yellow shapes, triangles, circles. Those are antigens. And in the ABO blood group, the types of antigens determine your blood type in that blood group. All right? A person with type A blood has A antigens on the surface of the red blood cells. Now, the plasma, which is outside of the red blood cells but part of the blood, therefore does not have anti-A antibodies. If it did, that person's antibodies would attack its own blood. So a type A person has A antigens, but not anti-A antibodies. Instead, he has anti-B antibodies that are there to recognize B-type blood, which is not that person's blood. Exactly the converse is true for a type B person. A type B person has B antigens on the surface of the erythrocytes, or red blood cells, and the plasma does not have anti-B antibodies, it has anti-A antibodies. An AB person has both types of antigens, A antigens and B antigens on the surface of the cells, and therefore doesn't have either type of antibody, because either type of antibody would attack those cells. And then the other possibility is a type O, which doesn't have either type of antigen on the surface, as you see, and therefore the plasma has both kinds of antibodies. All right, those are the situations with respect to anatomy. Now, let's consider why this is exceptions to Mendelian genetics. I said it's two different exceptions, and the exceptions don't really have anything to do with each other. It's just the same example used twice. One exception is called multiple alleles. And when I gave you the first exception, the only one we've already talked about, which was incomplete dominance last time, I told you that just the name of that should indicate to you that that's an exception to Mendelian genetics, right? Why is that true, by the way? Why does the phrase incomplete dominance, which was the previous exception we looked at, why does that phrase tell you just from the words that it's an exception to Mendelian genetics? Right. When you think about the two, let's mention again the requirements for Mendelian genetics. There's two of them. What are they? If a gene behaves in a Mendelian fashion, there has to be two things true for you to get those familiar ratios we were talking about. Well, those are possible genotypes, and that applies to any genetics, really. The requirements for it to be Mendelian are, one, that whatever gene you're talking about has to have exactly two alleles. All right? And the other is one of those two alleles has to completely dominate over the other. There has to be complete dominance. So, incomplete dominance, the phrase itself tells you that that's an exception because it's not complete dominance. All right? So, that's what I meant when I said the phrase itself gives it away that it's an exception. Well, so does the phrase multiple alleles, because the other requirement is that you have to have exactly two alleles. And multiple here doesn't mean two or more. Multiple means three or more. Well, if you have three or more alleles, obviously you do not have exactly two alleles, which is what Mendelian requirement is. So this is an exception to Mendelian genetics for that reason. In this particular example, you have three alleles. And the alleles are listed as genotypes. Remember that each individual symbol in a genotype represents one allele. That's why if you have, for instance, when we were talking about flower color, uppercase P, lowercase P, that's two symbols, right? Two alleles, because it's a diploid individual. Each individual letter, though, or symbol, represents one allele. And so the alleles are listed here as haploid genotypes. But notice they start with I. The I here stands for immunoglobulin, which is just the kind of protein that antibodies are. But a superscript is added in the case of A and B to indicate that it's the A version of the allele, the B version of the allele, and in the case of O, it's just a lowercase I with no superscript. That corresponds to the fact that a type O person doesn't have any antigens, so there's no superscript. All right? Just no antigens on the surface of the cell. So that is the fact that you have more than two alleles means that you're not going to have the familiar Mendelian ratios. It's an exception simply for that reason. There's an entirely different reason that it is also an exception, though. And that other exception is called codominance. Now, don't confuse codominance with incomplete dominance. We already talked about incomplete dominance. That's a different thing. Codominance is the situation in which you have two alleles that do not, neither of which dominates over the other. Co means share, right? And therefore, instead of one phenotype corresponding to one of those alleles being expressed and the other one not being expressed, both of the codominant phenotypes are simultaneously and fully expressed. In this particular example, the A allele and the B allele are codominant. The A allele makes you type A, gives you A antigens on your surface. The B allele gives you B antigens. Well, if you are a heterozygous individual with one of each, an A and a B allele, then you are type AB. You're not type A or type B only. You are both simultaneously. A type AB person is just as much a type A person as a fully type A person, but at the same time is just as much a type B person as a fully type B person. So both phenotypes simultaneously are fully expressed in codominance. In this example, though, both of those alleles, A and B, are dominant over O, which is why the only way that you can be an O person, since it's recessive, is to be homozygous recessive, as you're familiar with. lowercase I, lowercase I. If you are heterozygous with an A and an O, which is what IAI by itself means, because of A being dominant over O, that makes you a fully type A person. Okay? Well, of course, also if you are IAIA, homozygous A, then you're going to be type A. Similarly, IBIB is fully B, type B, and so is IBI, in other words, BO. Right? So there is dominance of A and B both over O, but A doesn't dominate over B, B doesn't dominate over O, over A. Okay. Oh, by the way, just since this is clinically important just in case you're interested, you might have heard the terms universal donor and universal recipient. You have to be careful with those phrases because that does not mean universal donor of whole blood and universal donor of universal recipient of whole blood. That would be a fatal mistake, potentially fatal mistake if you do that. What I mean is that if you transfuse whole blood from a type O person, O is known as the universal donor, right? But if you give whole blood from a type O person to any of these other types, that's bad news. Because whole blood is the O cells plus the O plasma. And the O plasma has both anti-A and anti-B antibodies, which means it will attack all three of these. The plasma will attack all three of these kinds of types. That's why a type O is only a universal donor of red blood cells. You take whole blood out of a type O person, put it in a centrifuge, spin it down so that you can separate the blood cells from the plasma that floats above it, give them just the cells, and that's no problem because an O cell doesn't have any antigens, and therefore it doesn't matter what the recipient's plasma has. No kind of antibodies can hurt this because it doesn't have any antigens they can recognize. And just AB is called the universal recipient, but that's once again only of red blood cells. You wouldn't want to give AB plasma from anyone other than a type AB person, because an AB cell can't tolerate either kind of antibody, and the only type of plasma that doesn't have either antibody is type AB. You see what I'm saying on all that? When you transfuse whole blood, you have to have a complete match between donor and recipient. All right, 13. This rat example is yet another exception to Mendelian genetics. This is one that has a name that's often mispronounced, called epistasis. And before I get into the definition of that, let's just look at the picture here for a second. How many characteristics are involved in this slide? Yes, it is one, which is what? Right, fur color, coat color. Notice there's three different traits, though, right? Well, where else did we encounter this situation of one characteristic but three traits? Which ones? Right, that was the incomplete dominance example, right? That had three traits, white, pink, and red, but only one characteristic. That's not what we're looking at here. Here we have three traits, one characteristic, but unlike the incomplete dominance where there was only one gene involved, right, just the flower color gene, here we have two genes involved. How do we know? Or if I hadn't even told you that, how would you... What about this slide tells you that we're dealing with two genes? That's right. Look at the genotypes. There's two different kinds of letters. Four overall letters. These are genotypes. But there's two B's and two C's. So they're diploid genotypes, right? That's why there's two B's and two C's. But the B gene is a separate gene compared to the C gene, right? In slide, whatever it was, with the incomplete dominance, 11, there was just one gene involved. Okay? Here in 13, we have two different genes, a B gene and a C gene. And that's because what we're dealing with here is epistasis, as I said, and epistasis is a type of gene interaction. Now, just the word interaction tells you that you must be dealing with at least two genes, otherwise it wouldn't be called an interaction. Right? And we do indeed have two genes involved here. Now, the B gene, well, kind of ambiguous. B could stand for black or brown, but it does stand for black because black is dominant over brown. The B gene is the gene that, when it's expressed, what does that mean, expressed? What does gene expression consist of?
That what is portrayed, or the dominant color?
No, I'm not even really talking about anything to do with dominance or recessivity. Just I'm asking what the definition of gene expression is. It's from last unit. You've already been tested on this. Two major parts of gene expression. What are those? Right. Gene expression refers to transcription of a gene first to make the messenger RNA, and then translation of the mRNA to make the protein, the polypeptide. So we're talking about protein-coding genes here. The ultimate product of a protein, the protein product, the gene product is the protein itself, which does something in the cell. That's why it's the proteins that directly give organisms their traits. Well, in the B gene for these rats, the gene product is a protein that makes a pigment either brown or black. So the B gene is responsible for producing a pigment type, either brown or black. All right? The C gene, on the other hand, doesn't produce any pigment. The C gene produces a protein, just like any protein-coding gene, and that protein operates as a transcription factor for gene B. Do you remember what transcription factors are? This is also something you've already been tested on. So think back to transcription of a gene. A gene is just part of a chromosome, right? How does the cell know where a gene starts if it's just part of the overall sequence? What is at the beginning of a gene? There's a special sequence at the beginning of the gene. What is that called?
Start codon.
Start codon is for translation. We're talking about transcription, so this is part of the DNA. You're trying to make messenger RNA out of the one DNA strand that is the gene. How do you know where the beginning of that gene is? How does the cell know?
The amino acid.
That's part of translation. We're building messenger RNA. Before we can even get to the point of considering translation, we have to first make the messenger RNA. So you have a long stretch of DNA that's the chromosome. This little section is a gene, and the cell recognizes that because there's a first little sequence called the promoter. Remember this? The promoter is the place at the beginning of the gene where RNA polymerase, the enzyme responsible for producing the mRNA transcript, binds to the DNA to get that process started. Initiation of transcription. Does this stuff sound familiar? Okay. Well, when I was talking about that originally, I told you that especially in eukaryotes, which is what we're looking at here in the rats, the RNA polymerase molecule is not able to bind to the promoter until some other proteins are already stuck there to begin with. And those are called transcription factors. If those proteins aren't there, then the messenger RNA can't bind to the promoter and the gene will remain off. It won't be expressed. I think in the slide that RNA polymerase was kind of egg-shaped and the transcription factors were little spheres in that cartoon. Do you remember this? Okay, well, where do the transcription factors come from? They are proteins. Where do they come from? From gene expression, like all proteins. No cell can produce any protein of any type unless it's explicitly told how to do so by instructions that come from genes. So the transcription factor that has to bind to the B gene in order for the B gene to get turned on, that's a protein that is the product of the C gene. You following me here? So the C gene gets transcribed. It makes messenger RNA. The messenger RNA then gets translated and a polypeptide is built. That polypeptide is now a protein that acts as a transcription factor and binds to the promoter of the B gene so that the B gene can then be transcribed to make its own messenger RNA. Otherwise, the B gene will stay turned off. Did you follow all that? That's an example of epistasis. Specifically, as a definition, epistasis is the situation in which the product of one gene affects the transcription of another gene. And in this specific case, the B gene is the one being affected by the C gene. The C gene allows the B gene to work. All right, so the B gene in this example is the one that actually produces the pigment as the final product. And there are two alleles here for the B gene. Just like there were two alleles for the flower color in pea plants. There was either purple or white. Here there's either brown or black. And black is dominant over brown. But if that gene stays turned off, no pigment will be produced, right? And it will stay turned off unless the protein that's produced because of the C gene is present at the promoter of the B gene. And specifically, the correct transcription factor, that protein that allows for B to get turned on, is produced only by the dominant version of the C gene. So there are two alleles for the C gene as well. Uppercase C is the dominant one, and that, if you have an uppercase C, it's fully dominant. So all you need is at least one uppercase C to produce the correct protein that will turn the B gene on. But what happens if you are homozygous recessive for the C gene? That means you do not produce the correct protein to turn the B gene on. And therefore, it doesn't matter what alleles are in the B gene, it's going to stay off. And therefore, no pigment is deposited into the hairs. Notice these four white rats. All of them, and only these, have two lowercase c's. So the C gene doesn't work to produce the correct protein that can turn the B gene on, and that's why in all four of these white rats, it doesn't matter at all what the B is. The B says whether you make brown or purple, but you're not going to make either if the B gene remains turned off. And it requires a capital C, an uppercase C, to turn the B on. That's why these are white. Now, if you have one or two, but one is enough, uppercase C, one dominant coloration gene, that's what the C stands for, then you'll make the protein that will then bind to the promoter of the B gene and allow it to be turned on. So in all these ones that are either brown or black, there's at least one uppercase C allowing the B gene to work. And then if that's true, you just look at the B genotype to figure out whether it's going to be brown or black. Since black is dominant over brown, one uppercase B is enough to make it black. One or two will be black, and the only way it'll be brown is if you have two lowercase B's. All right. Now this one over here isn't brown because its lowercase b's don't work since C is also lowercase. That is epistasis. Now tell me if any of that doesn't make sense, because it's more complex than what we've talked about before. It's gene interaction. All right. Notice the unfamiliar ratio. You don't get that ratio in Mendelian genetics, 9 to 3 to 4. Okay, let's go to 14. Well, actually, no, let's don't quite yet go to 14, because before I forget to mention it, there's another exception I want to talk about before slide 14, but I don't have a picture for it. So it's kind of like 13 and a half. This next exception that you'll just have to listen to me about is another one that's mispronounced a lot. It's called pleiotropy. Pleiotropy is the situation in which one gene affects multiple different characteristics. And like I said, I don't have a picture for you, but a good example is one that we've already talked about several times, but for different reasons. And that is the hemoglobin and sickle cell example. Right? We talked about this already when we were discussing mutations. There's one gene involved, the gene for human hemoglobin, and there is the so-called wild type, right, which is the most frequently encountered allele in the population. The wild type codes for normal hemoglobin, normally shaped hemoglobin, that if the normal hemoglobin is made, will function well to do hemoglobin's job, which is to carry oxygen and carbon dioxide in the red blood cells. But there's also the mutant form, which causes misshapen hemoglobin molecules to be made, which not only don't carry oxygen and carbon dioxide very well, but they cause the cells themselves to be misshapen. That's why the disorder is called sickle cell disease. They look like little sickle shapes instead of biconcave discs. And that is bad. That's a bad condition to have. Now, if you think about this, you might be asking, why is it that that the mutant form still exists? You would think, maybe, that natural selection would phase it out over generations. If it's that bad for you, then certainly not having it will give you an advantage, and natural selection should select for the wild type version, and each successive generation should have a lower and lower percentage of these mutant alleles in them. That's the way natural selection does work. And that's the way it would work if it were only bad for you. But this is actually an interesting case that it's kind of like a 182 topic, so you might learn this again if you take 182. But this hemoglobin example is what's known as the heterozygote advantage. Here's why, and this is also why the mutant form still exists. If you are a person who is homozygous normal, meaning you have two of the wild type alleles for hemoglobin, then you are completely normal, meaning the only type of hemoglobin you make is the well-functioning kind, and obviously you don't have sickle cell disease. If you are homozygous mutant, which means both of your hemoglobin alleles are the sickle cell type, then you're going to have sickle cell disease, which is bad news. All right? But if you are a heterozygote, that means you have one normal allele and one sickle cell allele. And in this case, that one normal allele that you have is enough to keep you from having sickle cell disease. You make enough normal hemoglobin to not have the disorder. You would be a carrier of it, but you yourself don't have it if you're a heterozygous individual. That still doesn't explain why it wouldn't be phased out, though. The reason it's not phased out is that a heterozygous individual actually has an advantage over a fully normal person. And that's because the heterozygous individual, by having that only one mutant form, is more resistant to malaria than a fully normal person is. And so, especially in places in the world where malaria kills millions of people, it's advantageous to be a heterozygote more than a homozygous normal. And therefore, it's the heterozygous individuals that are in high frequency in the population, and they all pass that allele on, and that's why it persists in the populations. Still bad news if you're the unlucky person that gets two versions, because that will give you sickle cell disease. But it's still going to be in the population as an allele because so many heterozygous individuals have it. All right? Now, the reason that is pleiotropy is because we're talking about one gene here, which up to now we've been associating one gene with one characteristic, like flower color, for instance. But here we have one gene that influences two different characteristics. One characteristic is the hemoglobin shape, and another characteristic is resistance to malaria. Right? So that's why it's pleiotropy. Now we can finally get to 14, which we've been staring at but haven't been talking about. This is another exception, but this is not pleiotropy. This is an example that's called polygenic inheritance. And so what does that word mean, just when you look at it? Not inheritance, but polygenic. Many genes, exactly. Poly means many. Polygenic inheritance is the situation in which several genes influence one characteristic. The example we're looking at here is for human skin color. Now, for all the other examples, when it was just one gene corresponding to one characteristic, like in flower color, it's an either-or situation, right? Either purple or white. Nothing in between. That's not the case for skin color. For some reason, we're always using the term white person and black person when there's really no such thing as either one of these, right? There is no such thing as a white person. Even an albino is not white. There's no such thing as a black person. All people are some shade of brownish red. Red from the blood and brown from melanin, the pigment, human pigment. And there's all kinds of gradations from between two extremes. In other words, human skin color exists on a continuum, which is a continuous scale between two extremes and everything in between. And that's true in other cases of polygenic inheritance. You have instead of having an either-or situation for phenotype, you have a continuum. The reason that it is a continuum, the reason that there are so many different shades between the extremes, is because each of multiple different genes are exerting their influence simultaneously on that same characteristic. So I don't know exactly how many genes are involved, but this figure pretends that there are six. That's why there are six dots in each of these zygote boxes. Each dot corresponds to an allele. And actually, I guess it would be three genes in this case. Two alleles for each. But anyway, a circle that is not filled in is the allele version that doesn't deposit any melanin. The dark one deposits some melanin. But how many of those you have depositing determines how much overall melanin is deposited. Melanin gets deposited in the skin cells called keratinocytes. And multiple genes, each contributing some of that melanin to the overall total, is why it's not just two shades. It's everything in between. All right, that's polygenic inheritance. Now, when you compare these last two exceptions, polygenic inheritance and pleiotropy, in a sense, they're in one sense at least, they're opposites of each other. Pleiotropy, remember, is one gene influencing multiple characteristics. So that's like a divergence. One gene, multiple characteristics. Diverge means to split apart. But polygenic inheritance is like a convergence coming together, because you have multiple genes influencing one characteristic. All right, let's go to 15. Well, these two plants, if you only care about flower color, obviously have different traits, right? If you're not colorblind, you can tell that the flower color trait is pretty drastically different in these two individuals. And so, based on what we've learned so far in this chapter, it would be reasonable to assume that these two plants have these different flower colors because they have different alleles for the flower color gene. In other words, because of genetics, they are different. Because of their genetic makeup, they are different in their flower color. But that's actually not, in this example, why that's true. They do have different flower colors, but that's despite the fact that these two individuals are actually genetically identical. So how can genetically identical individuals have different phenotypes? How does that happen? How is it that two genetically identical individuals can have different traits or different phenotypes? This is not something I've told you already. I'm just asking whether you have any idea how that can happen.
Would that be like mutation?
No, because mutation, if it happened, would be they have different DNA now. Because mutation changes the DNA. When they have identical DNA, that means neither is a mutant compared to the other. So it's nothing to do with the DNA. The DNA is identical in both. In other words, what besides DNA can determine a trait? Exactly. That's the important point shown here. That although it's definitely true that there is a genetic component to phenotype, there is also an environmental component. For instance, if you plant identical plants, genetically identical plants in soils of different pH, they're going to end up looking different. I don't know whether it was pH that caused this here. It might have been, but I just don't know. But I mean, just imagine this with humans. Identical twins in humans are really an accident. That's one sperm and one egg, which normally produces one human, right? But in the case of identical twins, when it's still one cell, the zygote, it accidentally splits into two identical zygotes, but then each one becomes a separate embryo that are genetically identical. And so you can have identical twins, genetically identical at birth. If they're separated at birth and live 80 years in different parts of the world, and then suddenly discover each other, they're no longer going to be identical, right? They will resemble each other, but they're not going to be identical because they've lived totally different lives. Our bodies come from the environment. They're built out of the things we eat, and they're continuously being renewed. The body you have now is not the body you had last week. It's always being rebuilt out of the stuff that's around you. So sometimes we use the phrase nature versus nurture. Have you heard this phrase? That's talking about the fact that there is a genetic and environmental component to phenotype. The nature part of that phrase refers to what you get as your genes, and the nurture part refers to what you do in your life. In other words, your environment. 16. These little family trees that you see here are called pedigrees. And pedigree analysis used to be a bigger thing than it is nowadays. Used to be important in humans, trying to figure out the DNA of humans for specific genes. In other words, to try to figure out genotypes. The reason for this is because, for multiple reasons, you can't just subject a human to a test cross and then look at the offspring, right? I mean, it's illegal and unethical to breed humans just for the sake of looking at the experimental results. But even if it weren't, it would be a pain in the ass, right? It would take a long time. But anyway, we don't do that with humans. Instead, we look at family trees or pedigrees and try to use logic based on how dominance and recessivity work. to figure out an individual's genotype. For instance, if you have a recessive trait, we know it's recessive, and neither of your parents has the recessive trait, what does that tell you about your parents? What is the only way that that's possible genetically? You have the trait, it's recessive. Neither of your parents has the recessive trait. Right, they both have to be heterozygous. And we encountered exactly that example with the F1 purple-flowered pea plants, right? They were all heterozygous, upper lower P. When you cross a F1 with an F1, neither one of these is white-flowered, right? But when you do that cross, three-quarters of them end up with one upper P and therefore are purple, but one-quarter of them are white. To be white, you have to be homozygous recessive, which means you have to have gotten a recessive allele from each of your two parents, which means each of them has to have a recessive allele. But since they don't have the recessive trait, that means they both also have to have a dominant allele. So they have to be heterozygous. And that's the kind of deductive reasoning that goes on in pedigree analysis. But it's kind of outdated in a sense now, because it's pretty routine nowadays to easily get someone's DNA and actually directly test the DNA. That's only fairly recently that we're able to do that, though. Well, speaking of testing DNA, slide 17 shows you two kinds of prenatal tests that can be done to test the DNA of a prospective child. These accomplish the same thing. They harvest DNA from the fetus for the purpose of looking at the DNA, but they're done at different times during pregnancy. And the later one is actually shown on the left, amniocentesis. Notice that this fetus is much more developed than this fetus. This is right after embryonic stage. But in amniocentesis, it's called that because you, with a needle, sample the fluid called the amniotic fluid that the fetus is more or less swimming in until it's born. And so it's moving around in there, and cells from the fetus are just sloughing off the surface just like they are for our cells. And they're mixed in with the amniotic fluid, and therefore you get a sample of the cells without actually stabbing the fetus, and you can then run DNA tests. The earlier one is chorionic villus sampling. This is earlier on when there is a lot of placental tissue. Placenta is an interesting organ because it's half the property of the mother and half the property of the fetus at the same time. Their bodies come together, and that's where transport is made between them. But anyway, once again, without actually directly sampling the fetus, you can suction off some of the placental tissue and then get fetal cells that way for sampling. Yeah, that's what I thought. 18 and 19 are these typical summary slides at the end, and I don't read those to you. I've covered all of this, but you might want to study them. Notice that pleiotropy is in there. That's the one I didn't have a figure for, but sickle cell disease. And that means we're done with the chapter. And even though I have some time left, I'm going to stop there. We'll do the other chapter in the final week. Two meetings will be plenty for that final chapter.